Okay, so let's just quickly review a little bit, because I know this is, like I said, when I started it, it seemed deceptively easy until I actually started talking about it, and then I realized it wasn't. So, quickly to summarize what we've seen. So the Mishnah had discussed a machloket, whether, at least the simplest understanding of it, was whether, and this again, this is after the Gemara's interpretation, whether something which is safek, muchan, whether something which may or may not have been set aside before Shabbos, is it mukta? The specific case that the Gemara brings is Rabbi Gamliel's position, that Rabbi Gamliel felt it was permitted, and therefore when a non-Jew had brought him a gift on Yom Tov, gift of fish, he said that fundamentally he thought it was permitted for him to have it, but he wasn't going to take it himself because he hated the guy. And then, as Rashi takes it, other Rishonim take it differently, which we'll come to later. The Tanakhama had said that in order for something to be permitted, you need to know actively that it was prepared. And the Gemara brings three different examples of this principle of safek muchan. Now, we've seen that the Rambam is an outlier here, because despite this discussion, the Rambam thinks this is not actually the machlok, because the Rambam thinks that even if something was for sure not prepared before Yom Tov, but was brought by a non-Jew, it would still be permitted. Why he thinks that is not totally clear. It seems to be based on the Yerushalmi, where there is such a position in the Yerushalmi, that Akum Lutzara Chachain, that a non-Jew, something he brings on Yom Tov, doesn't need to be designated before Yom Tov. It's automatically not mukta. We suggested that that could be either because, for one of several reasons, either because something is mukta if you didn't have it in mind. Perhaps they're simply arguing about what do you have in mind, right? Do you have in mind the possibility that a non-Jew might bring you something or not? More likely, it's a more fundamental dispute. In general, in muktzah, you find two sort of poles. Some who say that something is muktzah, right? Our starting point is that everything is muktzah until you actively designate it, right? Most things in the world are muktzah unless you say, this is the type of thing I'm going to use in Shabbos or Yom Tov. Others say that no, most things are not mukta. Things are mukta because you actively push them out of your realm. This is how Rav Chonsin had explained sort of the two, or to put it a little bit more formally, the way he put it is something mukta, is mukta a function of the requirements of hachana? Meaning, is something mukta because really you should prepare everything before Shabbos, and therefore anything you didn't prepare is outside your realm, because you have an active obligation to bring things into the Shabbos mode. If you don't, they're muksa, or is it not true, right? Everything we assume is not muksa, unless we have a reason to say we push it out. I mean, it also may depend on which muksa, which, different types of muksa may be different things. But that's really, as we get into muksa, we'll see that. But perhaps that's the machlokas in the Yerushalmi, that if you think that anything that a non-Jew brings is presumed muksa, that's because it lacked preparation. Obviously, the non-Jew had in his property, he isn't chayev, he isn't obligated to keep Shabbos, and therefore the fact that he had it doesn't make it prepared for Shabbos. But on the other hand, because he's not thinking about Shabbos, it also can't be pushed aside. So if you think you need it to be pushed aside to be mukta, anything in his property is not. If you think you need it to be actively prepared, so obviously anything in his property is not actively prepared. So those were two of the possibilities that we had suggested. The third possibility in the Tzlach is that the muktzah we're talking about here isn't a real muktzah or isn't a full muktzah. It's a muktzah that is a subset of our trying to keep you away from violating malacha on Yom Tov. And the argument between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Gamliel is how bad is hunting, fishing, and the like on Yom Tov? Is it d'orais or d'rabbanan, subject to the machlokas we'd seen at the beginning of the parak? That was sort of one. The next thing we'd asked is why... how would anybody say that muktza, when you're not sure that something was prepared, it's muktza, isn't muktza derabbanan? And the general rule is subject derabbanan lakula. Whenever we have a doubt about muktza, it's always going to be right lenient. So why is the way we paskin, forget, right? Why is the way we paskin stringent? So we'd seen several possibilities. One was the Tosfos Yeshanim, at the beginning of the Masechta, number 10 here, who says in general, muktza is not really derabbanan. Muktza is a ke'en d'araisa, it's sort of biblical. What does it mean, sort of biblical? So either it means that we treat it as if it's biblical, all right, it's a super derabbanan, or it has, sort of biblical aspects to it, right? Like the Ramban is really the one who says this. The Ramban, Ala Torah, says that there's a mitzvah called Shabbaton, right? To make Shabbos dik. Right? In addition to not doing all the malacha, you're supposed to keep Shabbos dik. And he hints to the fact, or almost explicitly says, that muktza, while it is rabbinic, wasn't created in a vacuum. Chazal sat down and said, how do we create an atmosphere which is Shabbos dik? And one of the things they said is muktza, right? Things which are useless, things which are used for prohibited reasons, for malacha, you can't even move them, you can't be involved with them, right? So it's part of this sort of biblical value system, even if it's not actually biblical. So that might be what he's getting at. The Meiri had said maybe, it seems from the Meiri, that maybe this wouldn't be a rule about muktza in general, it's a rule about this muktza, right? That this muktza is a bit different, because as we had seen in the Tzlach, maybe this muktza is really a way of dissuading you from violating Malachar and Yom Tov, and therefore it's a, right, it's a more strict muktza. Maybe this muktza is going to be unique. Rabbi Akiva Eiger had suggested something different, and he said maybe this is really part of a different rule, which is related to Dabar Sheish L'Matirin. Right, then in general, we have a principle in Shas that if something is going to become permitted, so then it isn't. It can't be nullified, because you might, right, we discussed a little bit last week the complexities of this, but let's not get into that again and just simplify it and say the simplest reason is what Rashi says, is lama lechlo be'isr lechlo be'heter, why bother eating it when it might be prohibited, eat it when it's permitted. And if that's the case, so you might say that even by derabanan, since the thing will be muktza tonight, will be permitted tonight, so then it is, you have to wait. Though, the problem with that, and the possible access to machlokes, and this is in general the machlokes, whether Dabar Sheish L'Matirin applies to cases like this, is, does lost opportunity count? Right? Because here, it's true. The food, if you look at the object, the food can be eaten tonight. But if you look at the opportunity, meaning using this as part of my Simchas Yom Tov, the opportunity is lost. There's no way of recouping that by waiting till tonight. So, at some level it is, at some level it isn't, sort of matirable. And that was where we had left off last week. And the Pnei Yeshua notes in 12, building on that, we didn't get to this last week, but the Gemara later on distinguishes between two different possibilities. When we say it's prohibited, all these things are prohibited, the Gemara is going to note that there's two possibilities of what that means. Either it means it's prohibited to eat, or it means it's prohibited even to move. And the Pnei Yeshua, in that context, writes, and this is 12, Ukvar Allah bilibi lomar dil inyan tiltu lo shayach ach melsa de davar sheish l'matirin sheish ksat svar lomar kein el di efshar. Is that the whole notion of Dabar Sheish L'Matirin only makes sense if the Gemara concludes that when we say it's prohibited to do something, it means to eat. But moving it, right, which is clearly action-oriented, right, food, you can at least say, okay, I'm eating it, tonight I'll eat it, I'm only going to eat it once. So you could say, look, I'm losing the opportunity. It's true, I'm losing the opportunity cost of eating now. But big deal, I'll eat it tonight. I was only going to get to eat it once anyways. But moving it, I can move it now. I can move it in 3 hours. I can move it in 6 hours again. Right? Like, and therefore, it's not really yeshal material. In the next 6 hours, if I want to move it around, for whatever reason I want to move it around, and you say I can't, right, I'm not going to be able to recoup that action. Right? If you say it's even prohibited for me to move, and davar sheyesh matirin makes no sense, right? Davar sheyesh matirin only makes sense when you're talking about a one-time thing. I could do it now, I could do it later. Not something that I could do. You know, that would be like saying, right, well, you know, I could, I don't know. I'm not a sports person. But, right, when you have like multiple games in a row, right, saying I could catch the next game doesn't mean you're going to catch this game, right? If you're, right, if you want to, right, for people who care about sports, if their team is playing at 2, even if there's another game at 6, right, they can't just say, ah, well, let's, you know, do something else. You know, let's go and do whatever at 2 o'clock, big deal. I'll just catch the other game at 6 with a team I don't care about, right? I care about it too. And if I care about both teams, right, then I want to watch the game at 2 and I want to watch the game again at 6, right? You don't just say, well, I could do it again later. No, if I could do it twice, like, and I only let you do it once.
Season's tickets, right?
Exactly, right. So that's what Pnei Yeshua says. He said, what do you mean? How can you use davar sheyesh matirin by moving? What do you mean moving? If I don't know why the guy is obsessed with moving this fish, but if he, for whatever reason, he really wants to move the fish, he wants to move it at 12, and he's going to want to move it at 2, he's going to move it at 4, he's going to move it at 6. And you tell him, well, you can't move it at 12 because you might as well wait till 6. But he said, yeah, I was planning on moving it again at 6, right? I don't know why he wants to move the fish, whatever, but he wants to move the fish, whatever, I don't know. But we can be creative, right? He wants to come up with the fish, he wants it to be decorative, I don't know. Okay. I don't know. Fine. He brought him a fish in an aquarium, okay? He wants it. He wants to have it. He likes the look of the aquarium. He wants it to be calming, you know, while he's taking his nap. He wants it next to his bed. And while he's eating, he wants it next to his table. Whatever it's going to be. So that's what the Pnei Yeshua notes. That this whole thing only makes sense on the level of tiltul. Sorry, on the level of achila, of eating it. But on the level of tiltul, on the level of moving, davar sheyesh matirin doesn't make sense because, what do you mean? It's not, there are multiple opportunities. You're telling him actively, give one up, and that is, that's not something you can recover.
And you could say davar sheyesh matirin for everything.
Correct, and that's the thing, is in general we don't say it on opportunities. And that's why I said that, you know, I mentioned the example that, you know, Rav Heber had written this article in Misora that if you're not sure whether you ate meat in the last 6 hours, it could be 5, it could be 6, right? You have to wait till 6 because it's davar sheyesh matirin, because you could just wait an hour and then you could eat, right? But most poskim think it's not sure. Rav Jachta wrote a response, I don't know if he actually published it there, but it's on his website on Kol Torah, where he said he doesn't think the majority of poskim agree with that because it's not true, right? You know, we all know that, right? You had a barbecue for lunch, right? And then you show up at you know, somebody's house. They're having a birthday party. You know, they're having their kid's birthday party and they're having ice cream cake, right? It's true, you know, it's 5 o'clock. You're not sure. Did I finish the barbecue? It was like, you know, a brunch barbecue. Did I finish eating meat at 11 or 12? Right? So now you want to have the ice cream cake. So don't tell me, well, you just have to wait an hour. What are you going to do? You're going to cut the piece. You're going to take it home. It's going to melt. Or you're planning on having ice cream then anyways. The point is you want to be part of the birthday party, right? It's a lost opportunity. Right, that's the problem, right? Because here the issue isn't that the food is treif; it's that you can't eat it. And we're once you're talking about people-oriented things, right? It's a lost opportunity. It's not matirin, and that's, I think, the majority position. And that's what Pnei Yeshua really notes here. In the second line, he continues at the end. He says, "El al karchach nirli de ikter pluk de derava levi aliba derung am liel haynu mishum de emes lavi muksa gamor bedagim shenit zodu." And that's why he says, and this goes back to our point before, that this isn't real mukta. He must be, we're not really talking about mukta. Sharafilim nitzadu b'yom tov, lo v'miksa gamor. Even if they were fished on Yom Tov, they wouldn't really be mukta. Imishum del shel akomein sar chachana. Either because like the position of the Yerushalmi, that anything that belonged to a non-Jew doesn't need to be prepared. Or because you can't say that it was pushed aside. These are all the possibilities I mentioned before. What's really going on in this, what the Slach said before, as well, maybe this isn't real mukta. And the reason it's treated differently is because it's a mukta. We call it mukta. It's not really mukta. It's a gzera, right? It's a decree, because we don't want you to benefit from something that Yom Tov was violated for it. Okay.
So that still would make it a derabanan.
Right, but there are varying levels of derabanans, and right, it would.
That would be a lesser level.
It could be lesser, it could be more, depending on how much the concern is, right? This was something we saw, Dafid Ches, I think, right? That Gzeirot, the more likely it will lead to a Deraisa, the more we up Derabanans, right? And then we start seeing the phenomena of Gozen Gzeirot Gzeirot, right? Second order and third order Gzeirot. So sometimes Gzeirot are less Chamor, sometimes they're worse, depending on how dangerous we think it is to violate the biblical law. Okay, right, so now just turn back to 7 and 8 here. One of the things that makes this sugya even more complicated, what I'm about to say in general is not complicated. The specifics are a bit complicated, but in general makes sense, which is that part of what makes this complicated is that when we talk about doubt, doubt can mean a lot of different things, right? Doubt can mean 10% in the problematic direction. It can mean 90% in the problematic direction. It can mean 60-40. It can mean 40-60. It can mean 50-50, right? Doubt means a lot of different things. And therefore, sometimes the answer to questions isn't anything fancy. It's just saying that doubts from percentage, you know, from this level on are so close to being Usser, that we treat them as usser, at 50-50, it depends how chamor things are, and, you know, things which are very, very unlikely, we're very makil. This is true in life, this is true in everything, right? This is always true, right? You know, if you know, most things in life,
we have a miut of a miut, or a miut.
Right. We have this in halacha, miut, miut shebe miut, miut hamatsui, miut she'eino matsui, all these levels. We also have it in life, right? It's like most things in life, if you say you have a 1/50 chance, right, of this happening, we barely take into account. But when you go to, you know, if you're in the hospital, right, I remember when I was at the medical ethics conference, right, this is the difference between the rabbis and the doctors. The rabbis, they were asked a shaila, can a woman choose to undertake a risky surgery to have children? Right, the risk being a 2% chance of death. So the poskim all said, she obviously doesn't have to, but if she wants to, right, she really wants to have children, and it's dangerous for her, right? It was someone with a disease and whatever the whole story was. She's allowed to, because in halacha, 1 in 50 is insignificant. And therefore, she's allowed to take that risk. And all the doctors said, what are you, crazy? Right? A 1 in 50 chance she's going to die? We would never let somebody do that. Right? And when it comes to danger, doctors like 1 in 50 death? Right? Absolutely not. On the other hand, if it's, you know, you're going to take this pill and there's a 1 in 50 chance that you'll have a side effect of nausea, right? But it'll definitely get rid of your migraine. People will be like, I'll take it. I'll worry about the nausea later. Right? This is true in life always, right? The higher the cost, the more, right? Life is always like that. So halacha is like that too.
It's the severity, immediacy, and reversibility of the consequences, or the
exactly. Or you know, if you remember when we did this, I think I mentioned this at some point, that this is also in rabbinics, right? That this is, you know, as Rav Shurlo put it very nicely, that Chazal take the same things into account. What he called sikun, sikui, right, danger, plausibility, right, and mechir, right, and what's the cost of not doing it, right? That's what we always ask, right? How bad would it be if I don't take the risk? How bad will it be if I take the risk? And what are the chances that horrible thing will happen, right? That's what we always ask. So halacha is no different. So much of this sugya is complicated because the whole sugya constantly says suffik this, suffik that, suffik this, suffik that, suffik this, suffik that, as if every suffik in the world is 50-50. But that may not be true. The answer might be that some of these are 90-10s and some are 50-50s and some are 10-90s. So that's what the Rajba notes here in two places. The Rajba in the first one says, Avalo min harishato. So he says, Nire dibaha tanakama l'chumra. Va'afilu ba me'erav yamtov umma rishato mikul kolin asure. So he said, the Tanakama, he thinks, says that one of the examples that the Gemara had of suffik is if you have these discussions of the animal possibly caught in the net at which you checked or didn't check at different points the net, right? You didn't actually see the animal inside, but you saw that it was messed up, so you realized that something must have gotten in. So he says the Tanakama seems to be the most stringent. Why? Because he seems to hold that even if you come on Erev Yom Tov and you see that the net is messed up, but you don't actually go all the way up and see that the animal is caught, we're still worried that the animal you're looking at now was an animal that came in subsequently and was trapped on Yom Tov. Rav Shimon ben Elazar lekula, and Rav Shimon ben Elazar is more mekil. The kol sheniskalkala hametsuda kevadai mishavinan la. He says, why is Rav Shimon ben Elazar lenient? Right, Rav Shimon ben Elazar later on in the Gemara is the one who's lenient if you found the nets broken up. So he says it's not because Rav Shimon ben Elazar thinks that every case of doubt is permitted. It's because he said, look, I came out of Yom Tov, I set up a trap, and hey, the trap is messed up. I can tell that something's gone through it. And then I show up on Yom Tov, and hey, there's an animal there. There's a decent chance.
It's a 28.
Yeah, exactly. That's what he says. He said, it's not that Rav Shimon Elazar tells you every 50-50 I'm lenient on. He doesn't. He just thinks it's kivadai mishavinan la. It's as if it's for sure. Once, and he said, because, look, you saw it messed up. And besides, you know, once you have a perfect trap, you know, we all know, like, you know, there's like, I've only seen it in movies, but right, they have like, they dig a hole and then they put the perfect leaves on top. It only works once, right? Once the leaves are messed up, the hole, you can see. So the reason he's lenient is because he said, what are the chances an animal can lay later? V'chein mash b'Yerushalmi. Aval b'gmarin lo nirakein shelo chilku. And he said, the Yerushalmi, it sounds that way, because the Yerushalmi, as we saw earlier, made all these distinctions. Are you in a place where there's a lot of animals? Are you not in a place where there's a lot of animals? Da 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 da. He said, the Bavli doesn't make that explicit. Mikol makom lamati misham de tanakama de Rav Shimon is lehachein de choshed af bezu shemeli lo nisom du bivod yom. Right? So the Rashba says, the Bavli doesn't distinguish. But what I do realize is that the Tanakama is being very stringent. Because when he says, I'm machmir on safek muchan, what he means is I'm stringent even when it's 80-20 in the lenient direction. Right? Meaning he really, really wants it to be absolute that it's good. Otherwise, it's out. But Rav Shimon ben Elazar may just say, look, right, you may not be able to derive much from Rav Shimon ben Elazar. He just says, look, if it's 80-20 lekula, so I'm going to say it's mutter. That doesn't mean he'll say that in a 50-50. In 8...
So would they change their opinion depending on the trap you have?
Well, that's what he said. That's what the Yerushalmi said. That's exactly what the Yerushalmi said. Right, the Rajba says the Bavli doesn't sound this way, right. But the Yerushalmi, he said the Yerushalmi is very clear that this isn't an absolute machlokas, because it's not always, every doubt is asur, every doubt is mutter. It's different people draw the line different places. So in 80-20, let's say, Rav Shimon ben Elazar says, good. And the Tanakama still says, no, not good. But 50-50, Rav Shimon ben Elazar presumably would say, no, I don't like 50-50s, I just like 80-20s. In 8, the Rajma says this again, this time on the position, the expansion of Rav Gamliel. V'im tomer kevin de la rava sirim b'achila yich mutarn likabel u'talt el dami. Which this is okay. You know this. I'm going to hold on to this because the Rajba is going to say this sort of systematically throughout the sugya. Once we get to the questions about the position of Shimon ben Gamliel, we're going to see he's going to bring it in again. But we'll come back to that because we haven't actually read it in the Gemara yet. Okay. So now let's skip to 13. One of the things you have to consider in this sugya is not in this sugya at all. It's in the sugya in Shabbos. The sugya in Shabbos has a discussion there about whether it is permitted to set up traps before Shabbos in general, right? And that is part of a general machlokas between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai called Shvitas Kelim, right? Do we require you not only to rest, but do we require your vessels to rest? So if I set up a trap before Shabbos, I'm not trapping on Shabbos, but my trap may trap. Great.
It's a Jewish trap.
What?
It's a Jewish trap.
It's a Jewish trap. So the question is there such a thing as a Jewish trap? So Beis Shammai Omrim, this is number 13. Beis Shammai Omrim, Ein Parsim Mitzudos, Chayeva Ofos Vidagim, Agishadim Mibodyo. Beis Shammai says, I'm only allowed to set up a trap on Friday if it's going to trap on Friday. Beis Hillel Matirin. Beis Hillel says, no. You're allowed to set something up on Erev Shabbos for Shabbos. And this is how we pask it. Right now, we don't usually set up traps, but we set timers, right? Timers. This could be Paskin like Beis Hillel. When the poskim deal with whether timers are mutter or not, and when they're mutter or not, and things like that, it's because of a dirabanan, not of Shvi'as Kelim called different dirabanans, but because we have a problem on Shabbos of having things which make noise and destroy the atmosphere of Shabbos, actually Kala, right? They make noise. So, like when poskim talk about, is it mutter to leave your, your dishwasher on a timer, right?
Air conditioner
also. I mean, dishwasher is a big... Dishwasher, I haven't found so many poskim in America who are make it, although there are. In Israel, it's actually pretty common. In the kibbutzim, that's what they do. Like, they leave them on timers. But often, the reason they asur is not because of Shvi'as Kelim, it's because of Avshei Kala, because it makes noise and it, you know. Though, I'm trying to think. Or his uncle and aunt said they once asked Rav Taub.
Rav Moshe Feinstein didn't like...
Rav Moshe didn't like anything. Rav Moshe didn't like timers.
But the reason he gave was...
Because Avshei Kala. Yeah, but he didn't like timers, didn't like anything.
Yeah.
Right? Did anyone remember what Rav Taub said? I feel like he said it was permitted, because I've heard this story several times. But I'm not going to... Don't quote me on that. Right? Like, Manny and Linda always tell the story that they're... You know, this is a big machlokas, so they had gotten a psak that they could leave it on a timer, and when their kids came back from Israel, they had gotten a psak from their Rebbe that they couldn't, so they complained about it. So I think it was Roy Tao who just said, okay, so tell them that if they don't like it, they can do the dishes, right? So, right? And then they never complained about it again, right? That's always, you know, there's always a cost to a chavra, so, you know. But again, it's an avshei kala. I don't know if I should have said that in recording, but whatever.
You could get rid of it.
Nah, it's fine.
I think Ramosha didn't even like timers on lights.
No, he doesn't like on lights. And then eventually he's like, okay, only lights. Only lights.
Yeah.
But no one else agreed with him. Not no one else, but la halacha, no one really, really follows that. Okay. So there is this machlokes, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Now, all the Rishonim, therefore, said, well, wait a second. What's the working assumption in that Gemara? Right, that you can set up a trap that will trap on Friday, but you can't set up a trap that's going to trap on Shabbos. So they had the following very simple problem. The whole assumption of our Gemara is that setting up a trap does not give you any indication of when the animal is going to walk in. And the Gemara in Shabbos is assuming that you know when that animal is going to show up. such that Beis Shammai says if it's going to show up on Friday, it's permitted. If it's going to show up on Shabbos, it's usur. And Beis Hillel says, nah, even if it's going to show up on Shabbos, it's usur. So all the Mishnah, I don't understand. Our sugya assumes that there's a doubt, you don't know, right? And the Gemara there seems to think that you can have a fair enough gauge on the situation that you can say the animal's going to get here before Shabbos and it's mutter or not. Yeah.
Can I read Beis Shammai to be saying, if it's possible that an animal will go in on Friday, it's okay?
But well, it's only for sure.
Going to happen on Shabbos.
Oh, for sure you can. But this is what the Beis Shammai had to deal with. Is that the sim? Right, the first time you read our sugya, first time you read that sugya, right? And that's exactly the point. So right.
If you reduce it to the concept of possibility, then I don't think it's so.
Correct.
Doesn't fit in.
Correct, right? You could, right? Of course. Now, but what do you have to do? And what Alan's pointing out, you have one of two options. You have to pull the sugya towards each other in one of two directions, right? You have to say one of them is not as absolute as it seems. I mean, that's really the answer. The question is, which sugya do you pull, right? Which one do you pull in the direction of doubt, right? That's really the question, towards certainty.
Is it impossible to say that the Mishnah is referring to your intention?
Or it could be your intention, right? It could be, right?
And then you don't have to know whether it's coming or not. It's with
right.
That actually is more logical than what I said.
So if you look, I gave you two answers in the Mishnah. There can be others, but I just gave you two from Tosfos and the Miwi. So Tosfos says, how do you know when the animal is going to show up? So Yesh Lomar, the Yerushalmi Muki La Beparish Beharshin, the Mitzuyin Sham Chiyusa, Umayri Binyan Zeshel Yuchal Lil Chod Bimitzuda El Echad Ustayim. Da Mamo El Shizan Vod Yomim Yachal Etzud Gami Shechashecha. So Tosu says, well, you know what? Remember that Yerushalmi in our sugya? But the Yerushalmi in our Gemara said, in what case is everyone going to say it's mutter? Everyone's going to say it's, right? In our Gemara, we also said there are certain cases which are not real suffix. Namely, if you put a trap that can only fit one or two animals in a place with a lot of animals with plenty of time before Shabbos, then that's called a vadai. Why is it called a vadai? Because if it's a huge trap that can fit 100 animals, then it doesn't matter how many animals are around. So sure, 20 will get in before Shabbos and 80 will get in on Shabbos or who knows what. But as the Yerushalmi already noted, and we saw this in the Rajba, there are varying levels. You can create situations which are karov levadai, or gemara. When you're talking about safek, you're talking about the more doubtful cases. What's the case of vadai? As the Yerushalmi said, the case with a lot of animals, a small trap, which can only trap one or two animals, and if there's a lot of animals around, and you put it 3-4 hours before Shabbos, chances are the thing is full by the time Shabbos comes in. And therefore, when Beis Shammai says it's usur, unless it's going to be mi bel yom, he means, yeah, the case where it's basically vadai. And what is the case in the Gemara where it's usur? Where it's a big trap, where there aren't a lot of animals around, all those factors that Yerushalmi brought up that make it less likely for you to be able to predict. Yes, right? That's it. So that's how the Tosfos, right? Tosfos just takes the numbers game. Right, he says, it depends. Yeah, we've already seen that there's different situations, there are different cases, some are more likely than others. When Beis Shammai says it's mutter, it's the cases where you're pretty sure it's going to be fine. When the Bavli says that it's not, it's the cases where it's more doubtful. That's it, right? Work out the numbers how you want. He gives you one example. The Meiri gives a different answer. He says, "Olam mashnitza bohem aser kol haShabbos lechola lechol adam biyom dov mitam safek muchan." He said, "What are you talking about? There are two very different Gemaras. The Gemara in Shabbos says, is it mutter to set up the trap? The Gemara in Beitza is it mutter to use what's in the trap?" Right, and this really is a variation on the intent question. Right, meaning he's saying, "Look, there's two questions." One is, from the vantage point of Tzeda, is it Usur? The answer is no. You can leave something Erev Shabbos and pick it up on Tuesday. Who cares? That's fine. The question is, if you show up on Shabbos, is it Usur? Right? Now, the reason I think the Meiri doesn't say exactly what David says and just say it depends on your intent is because what you learn from Beis Hillel is no. Even if your intent is for it to trap on Shabbos, that's also Mutter. The only thing that's usher is using it on Shabbos. Right? That's the only thing. Right? It's tempting to say what matters is intent, but then you have to realize, no, it doesn't matter what your intent is, because it's actually fine. Right? It's actually totally fine to have something going for several days over Malacha. Right? This is the shayla I'm working on now for a shir next week, is sous vide cooking on Shabbos. This is a nightmare, right? You know what sous vide is? No? Okay, we get some yeses, some noes. Right? Down south, I get all yeses. Right? They're all into sous vide. It's the new thing. We're giving a gourmet cooking.
Do you know what?
See, this is the funny thing. I'm just saying, by the way, this is...
How can you leave it on Shabbos if the food isn't already cooked?
So one second. Right? So let me just explain what it is. Right? But this is when you know the difference in communities. Because, like, I first even heard what sous vide was, I'll tell what it is in a second, on YU Torah like a year ago. And everyone was like, yeah, we never heard of it. There's Bala Bayit in my shul. Ask me. That was a shul in the Five Towns. I was like, okay, that makes sense. Sure. Right? Toronto, right? Miller got the shayla a while ago. It's on from Toronto. He has more than one shayla on sous vide. What is sous vide? Okay, now to what sous vide is. Okay. Sous vide is when you cook meat, or let's take meat for an example, but it's not only meat. Normally, it gets cooked more on the outside than the inside, right? That's what it is, right? But that makes it shrivel, and it makes the juices fall out and all that. So sous vide is a new way of cooking where you, relatively new, or it's become more common, where you vacuum pack the meat, and then you put it in a warm water bath. Not hot, warm, and depending on the food, it could be anywhere from 115 to like 140 degrees. And it rotates it slowly around in the water for anywhere from between 1 hour to 48 hours, depending on the food. And it cooks the food completely evenly throughout, right? It like rotates it around in like perfect things. You control it from your phone, like whatever. And it becomes very succulent and juicy because all the juice stays in and it's cooked perfectly throughout and evenly. That's sous vide. And it used to be very, very expensive. It's becoming less expensive because now you can buy a sous vide machine for $150 online. You know, it's not like not a big chachma anymore. But anyways, that's sous vide. But one of the shaylas people ask about sous vide is if certain thing is mamish cooked for 48 hours. So people ask, okay, what can I leave it Friday afternoon for Sunday? Right? For Sunday. Right? Or can I leave it? So the original shayla I heard was, can I leave it? This guy was very fancy. He left it for 72 hours. He wanted to know, can you leave it Erev Rosh Hashanah for the third day of a 3-day Rosh Hashanah to have perfectly cooked sous vide meat, which takes 3 days because it gets, you know, whatever. I don't understand this, but I can't wrap my head around it.
Before Shabbos, four Shabbos.
Before Shabbos, four Shabbos. Right? Doing it on Shabbos is probably usher. Right, it's usher. It's usher. Probably usher midaraisa.
Well, you're cooking.
At what point does it become achal ben drosai?
Right. Well, so this is the thing. It's actually k'der chayisa. It's actually k'der chayisa. Mamish raw. Right. You put it in raw. Okay. Right. It's
cooked mainly, before Shabbos. I mean, 48 hours, and you put it in.
So there's all different permutations. So there's all different permutations. This is why I'm trying to like work it out, but it's impossible because you're mamish. So you're dealing with these that. It could go the whole Shabbos. It go through Yomim Tovim. So, but that's fine, right? The question is whether you could. I mean, possibly fine. It might not be fine, but not because of Daraisa, not because of Bishul, right? Honestly, Rav Asher Weiss thinks it's Aser because it's Hatmana, because it's Hatmana Medaber Hamos of Hevel Mamish. It's like it's a torture trial.
That's interesting,
isn't it?
Yeah.
When I come to a conclusion, I'll send my link to it, or you can come down south for it. It'll be a Shomri Shabbos. When I wrap my head around it, right now I'm like still.
The only reason I know what it is from my kids who live down south.
Okay. Down south they are mamish into their soup. But I have a cousin up here who does it, yeah. Whatever.
Do you ever see the pictures from the Trafe steakhouses where if you look at the steak, it's perfectly pink?
That's what it is.
And you can't do that if we cook it.
Correct.
Because, it's.
But you do is you sous vide it, right? You sous vide it. So, but now it's a new thing. This is the new in thing.
Yeah, they're all becoming vegetarian.
Yeah.
We like their meat, like
By the way, I found. But now I'm totally. So I saw Rabbi Miller Paskin. He said at least it's usher to put it in on Shabbos, Kamavan, because it's Bishul Daraisa, because it said it's Yatzel Ledes. But it's not actually true. Most foods are Yatzel Ledes. But the lowest temperature of Yatzel Ledes is 110 degrees or so. It's 40. Rav Moshe said 45 degrees Celsius. But certain things, certain types of fish, you cook at 44. They're not even Yatzel Ledes according to Rav Moshe. So I'm like, so I don't even know. I emailed like the contact to Rabbi Miller again. I'm like, and what about those fish? Is it mutter? Like, I don't know. Is it mutter lechatchila? I think it's not. I think it's, there's actually a case in the Gemara like this. There is a certain fish in the Gemara that is so tender that it's cooked even with like cooler water, and the Gemara says it's aser mishum bishul or makabe patish. So I think it's actually aser, but this is what I'm working through now. The point of this whole thing was, right, that you're allowed to have a malacha going through Shabbos. That's not the point, right? The point is benefiting from it on Shabbos is a problem, right? The only reason suvi might be a problem is because that's mana. That's mana is the rabbanan.
Wouldn't it be if you're doing it through Shabbos, you're making the chol on Shabbos?
Yeah, but if you start on Friday, right? These 48-hour things,
and you're not touching it.
You're not doing mamish,
so
right?
No beit shalai would permit it.
Listen to this, Shaila. Okay, whatever. Listen to this, Shaila. Right? The question normally, if you want to cook something over Shabbos, right? You want something cooking. And even in a mutter way, you need to be garu fukatum, right? You need to cover the heating element, right? That's why the blech, we cover the fire, we cover the knobs, whatever we do. Most of the new suvi machines function based on an app on your phone, right? So they're automatically garu fukatum. You turn off your phone, you can't access, right, the machine. It's like super, super garu fukatum. Anyways, it's great. There's so many cool shilas with sous vide. This week is sushi and rice paper. Next week is sous vide. I'm like, I'm having fun. So, yeah.
What would Rav Aaron Lichtenstein say about this this exaggerated focus on food? Can you imagine?
You don't want
to just
know.
Just had to say. I just have to throw it out there.
I need my scheme. I'm telling you. Okay. The COR and the OU both say that they really don't like making sushi on Shabbos. But shasat chak, if they really want it, they'll allow it to be done with a guy, and they, all this. And Rabbi Leibowitz said, he asked Rabbi Willig, and Rabbi Willig said, shasat chak? What are you talking about? It's, you need to have fresh sushi on Shabbos. Like, what is going on in people's heads?
Sushi emergency.
But you look at from Toronto, Rabbi Miller has a tshuva like this on whipped cream.
Yeah,
he says,
we
saw this when we did Nola. We did Molid, right?
Right.
You're allowed. Really thinks it's mutter, but you should only use whipped cream if it's under extenuating circumstances. I'm like, what emergency are you talking about? So I don't know. I'm with you. I don't get it. And Rav Asher Weiss in his tshuva also, he said, my approach to Shabbos is so complicated that all these new shailas, I look at them and I'm like, unless you can prove to me it's mutter, if there's no pressing need, I'm not going to say, okay, indulge in the newest God knows what. But anyways.
What's wrong with making sushi on Shabbos?
Monday's shir. The COR is Mekel Holiday Goy. The Star K is Mekel for even Lachatchila. The OU is Mekel B'Shasat Chak.
Assuming the rice is already Bone. Cooked.
Bone. I know you're looking at me like I'm crazy, but it's a Gemara. Not now. I'll send the link to the shir. Okay, I'll send the link. Okay. Last thing. We won't read through this whole piece because I don't want to spend more time on it. What muktzah are we talking about here? Right? What type of muktzah are we talking about here? So I bolded the different parts in the Pnei Yeshua. So there's different possibilities. One possibility is that it's muktzah machmas iser. Right? Meaning muktzah because it's aser to trap the animal on Yom Tov. That's one. Mm-hmm. Right? Two is that it's what we call like Eitzim Va'avanim, right? That it has no use because it's, right? Well, not really, but it's just because I was Aksinu Midaite, that's what he said, because since I couldn't trap it on Yom Tov, so Mimela, I didn't think about it before Yom Tov. Then he says it's another possibility.
But that would affect the trap, not what's in it.
Well, no, the animal also, because, right, since I didn't think I could trap something, I didn't think I, you know. It's closed, right? So then, if you just skip down to the next bolded part, he gives another possibility. He said maybe it's Nolud, right? Because it's something totally new. Because sometimes Nolud means something created new. Sometimes it means something that's new in your possession, right? What's the nafgamina? So the Gemara at the beginning of the Masechta said there's a machlokes Rabbi Huda and Rabbi Shimon about Mukta. And Rabbi Shimon doesn't believe in Mukta. He only believes in Nolud. But this might be Nolud, right? Which you have to say, because Rav Shimon is one of the people being machmir here. That's what he pushes it for, that it might be Nolud. So you have the possibility that Mukta machmas is, or it might be Nolud. And then he notes that in the Yerushalmi, right, you have more of an explicit discussion, but skip down to the next bolded part. He says, Mibod Yom El Shiodeb, Vada Shalidag Mitsuim Bot Soshav, Lobal Achar Mikan, Kagon Al Yedei Lechi, Kukri, Vahule, Vida, Shakoma Shistrach, the Harach Bazet, the Haimukta, the Mitsuz, Hain Mishum, the Vinolad Gamur. But his conclusion is that it's not Muksa Machmas Isser, that it's really Nolad. He says, why? Ugriya feel mishar nolad. I think it's even worse than a regular nolad. Hainu dafka lefi perish Rashi lekamon b'meimer dar papa dalai nokla feel lereb Shimon. Behainu lefi shitaso v'shita setos v'siatam. The kamel kerb Shimon muktzav v'nolad I feel b'yom tov. Said, why am I tempted to interpret this as nolad? Because Rashi and Tosfos seem to hold that this whole sugya is even according to Shimon. If the whole sugya is according to Rav Shimon, then you can't say that this is a normal mukta, because Rav Shimon doesn't hold of mukta. So therefore, you have to interpret the type of mukta as nolad, which brings us full circle, because as we said, not all muktas are created equal. And the mukta which is the closest to daraisa is nolad, because it's the one which is the most anti-hachana, and hachana is the one that has a pasuk. Right, and therefore Nolad, which is the most radical of them, might be the closest to Dioraisa's, and also the one that Rav Shimon holds of, which may be why it's also Besafik, and why Rav Shimon would agree. However, he notes that this is not necessary according to the Rambam, because the Rambam and the Rif paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, that there is an Isra of Mukta on Yom Tov, and therefore if you think that's true, right? If you think that this sugya is functioning according to the shita, that there's regular mukta on Yom Tov, then you don't have to come on to this. So the Pnei Yeshua just notes that which type of mukta you talk about here depends on how you paskin. According to Rashi and Tosfos, we paskin that there's no mukta on Yom Tov, and this sugya is even according to Shimon, so then in order for it to be mukta, the only mukta he believes in on Yom Tov is Nolad, it's something which is born anew, right? Or in this case, comes into your property totally new. But according to the Rambam and the Rif, who say that we paskin there's regular muksa on Yom Tov, so then you're free to say this is muksa machmas isser, right? Muksa just because of an isser, which is a more lenient level of muksa. But as usual in these sugyas, right, what you say depends on how you read every other sugya about muksa throughout the Masechta, which is just what the Pnei Yeshua highlights. Okay. Sure. Well, and there, and...